Hi, welcome to this podcast from WXXI in Rochester, New York. My name is Brenda Tremblay. Composer Glenn McClure is on a journey to the bottom of the planet. When he gets there, he's going to pitch a tent on an ice shelf and listen. I caught up with him right before he left.
The National Science Foundation in Washington, D.C., their Polder division has this fellowship for artists and writers and artistic creators. The idea is to send an artistic creator with an NSF scientist out into the field for the purposes of creating artworks that promote what that scientist does and what NSF does in general. The Polar Division of NSF really values the role and the power that artists have in conveying what they do to a broad public.
Well, I want to ask you a little bit about that, how art can underscore scientific data. But first of all, let me ask you why you're going to Antarctica. What are you going to do there?
I get to spend time in the field, okay, with Dr. Peter Bromirsky from UC San Diego.
And by field, you don't mean grass and birds.
I should qualify that. It's the ice. I will be pitching a tent on the Ross Ice Shelf and spending time with Peter's team. It'll be about 15 of us. And what I'm going to be doing is following his team in their work. He'll be checking on some seismographs that he put into the ice last year. We'll be uploading the data from those from those sensors, okay, and then starting to look at the ways in which that data describes the effects of global warming on the Ross Ice Shelf.
What are you going to do with that data?
Then what I get to do is to take that data and run it through some different mathematical transformation matrices, okay, and so those numbers are going to turn into melodies and harmonies and rhythms. There's a long history of composers writing music about nature, okay, and writing tone poems, musical pictures of nature. Smetana's the Moldau, that gorgeous musical picture of that river. What I'm interested in doing, though, is to go beyond just responding to the environment emotionally, but actually embedding the environment itself into the music. And we can do that with the math.
So you're taking the vibrations of the Earth's core in some way and in making them audible?
Well, what Peter does is that he measures infragravity waves.
Okay. What's infragravity?
It's something that I can't fully understand because I'm just a composer. Okay, but they are waves that Peter uses to measure the density, the thickness, the viability of the Ross Ice Shelf by sending these waves out into the ice. These obviously are waves that are not within the hearing range. And so part of my job is to take these waves that exist in other parts of nature and to pull them into the hearing range. And then that starts to drive the sort of raw material for music.
What excites you about that project?
Well, going to the bottom of the planet certainly does, I've done a bunch of partnerships with scientists already, with the European Space Agency.
You wrote a string quartet
last year.
Yeah.
Actually, a piece for string quartet and choir, and we worked with the orbital data from their Rosetta mission. And really got very excited about the aesthetic possibilities of embedding the science actually into the music, okay, in a very measurable kind of way. So to take that process and now go on an adventure to Antarctica is very exciting.
Are you nervous about surviving?
Well, I have the best team around me. Okay, in the world, the NSF folks are so thorough. They're so good at all the safety and security issues there.
Okay, and you're training before you go, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yes. Some of the survival mm-hmm. training and that yeah. sort of thing.
Well, it sounds like a thrilling project. How can art and music underscore or advance scientific understanding in a way that science by itself, you know what I'm getting at?
Absolutely. You know, I think there's two ways to unpack that. Okay, one is looking back to early history where you know with the ancient Greeks, music was simply just another branch of mathematics. It wasn't a separate discipline, and so going all the way up into the Renaissance into Galileo's time, that music was always naturally embedded with other things, okay? And it was right around the Renaissance where we started to separate these disciplines and put the scientists over there and the musicians over there, and they never get a chance to talk to each other, okay? And so I'm very excited about going back to these older ideas and putting the connections back together. That's the first thing. Second thing is that I know for myself, I'm not a data guy. Okay, if I get a piece of paper that has several columns of numbers on it, okay, my eyes glaze over. Okay, but of course, scientists regularly convert numbers into pictures, into graphs, because when we can see those numbers in a visual representation, we learn something new about it. So if we can change those numbers into visual representations and learn something new, what's going to happen when we change those numbers into sound? What new things can we learn about the realities, the truths, the beauties that are hidden within those sounds?
What effect do you want this project to have on ultimately the listeners of the music you're going to produce?
Well, first and foremost, the job that the National Science Foundation is giving me, okay, is to have more people understand the what scientists are doing down there and the importance of it.
So there's a big education component.
Yeah, and it's actually more specifically in the education side, we actually have several high schools, both here in upstate New York as well as across the country, that we're going to have students crunching these numbers and creating melodies, as well. Down at SUNY Geneseo, we have an amazing team of students that are doing directed studies on everything from the physics and geology and mathematics to the history of Antarctica to wrap a larger body of knowledge around the musical component.
Mm-hmm. So what's exciting to you as a composer about going to Antarctica?
Well, there's a couple things. First of all, I think that, as composers, it's kind of a natural impulse for us to go into our room and close the door and pull down the shades and write music. Okay, we often work in a very solitary environment, and the more of this work that I do with partnerships with scientists and other kinds of non-musical institutions, the more that I've really come to love this notion of the civic role of a composer. Okay, the composer that's out writing music in a crowd, in which the composer's job is to pull together multiple perspectives and to create a singular voice for those perspectives.
Fans of your career and your work probably remember your collaboration with Davis Sobel and Galileo's daughter, mm-hmm. Madrigalia, bringing together the story of Galileo and setting that to music too. Does this feel sort of like in the same category of a creative process for you?
Well, it's very much in the same vein because one of the things we talked a lot about when we did that project was the fact that Galileo himself was a marvelous musician. He was a lute player. His dad was a composer. Vincenzo was not only writing music, but he was pushing the limits of music in his own community. And so the young Galileo, grew up in a musical household and not only learned music, but also learned how to push the limits. And he went on to do that himself in the science world. So in many ways, there's a very strong connection to the that work that I did with Davis Sobel.
So you're leaving this week. You're going to be down there for a few weeks. When are you coming back?
That'll depend on the weather. Okay, I'm going down there in their springtime.
So what is the weather in the spring?
Weather in the springtime there is kind of like the coldest of what we get here in the winter in Western New York.
So below freezing.
Well below freezing. I'll be down there. The sun will not set while I'm there. It will move in an oval in the sky. And also the place where we're going is relatively close to the international dateline. And one of the things that that Peter has told me that everyone experiences is this disorientation of time, okay? Because so many of the things that govern our sense of time here in North America just are not in play there. And so as a composer, and I'm thinking of, oh, geez, how do I describe this musically? Well, there's some very easy ways to do that with mixing up the time of the music and using that sort of musical disorientation to actually describe the physical realities of being there.
What do you think it's going to sound like?
Well, it's going to be driven by what the ice has to say, and that's the exciting part of it. There's not a lot of preconceived notions that I can bring to it, okay? Because I have to listen to the ice first, and see what it gives.
No, I think it's fabulous that you're giving voice to the ice in the Antarctic and going on this great adventure. And I'm hoping that we can catch up while you're actually down there and trace this project to the spring when there's something that we can hear. We can hear the ice.
Yeah. I'm talking to a bunch of ensembles, hoping we can put together some initial concerts in the springtime, perhaps, or early summer.
Is there anything that you'd like to add that I haven't asked you about?
There is. One of the things that this project has kind of brought to the forefront for me is in my career as a composer, I've concentrated on the music, okay. But certainly one of the reasons why I became a musician to begin with was that I was born with a severe stuttering disability, and at the age of 11, okay, I learned a sort of intellectual control that I still use right now when I'm talking to you. Okay, so half of my brain is thinking about what I'm saying, the other half is constantly controlling all the muscles that make words. And when I use that control, my speech is as good as any normally disfluent person out there. That's a wonderful category that the speech pathology people have. But before learning that control, the only time that I could open my mouth without the physical and the emotional distress of the disability was when I sang. Because for a variety of reasons, singing circumnavigates the disability in a stutterer's brain. So what happened to me as a kid was that the stuttering silenced me, but music gave me a voice. It made me feel like I could connect to people. It made me feel powerful. It made me feel beautiful. And I think that's one of the reasons why I'm drawn to projects like this, because I'm looking for that voice in the silence of the numbers. I'm looking for that voice in the silence of the ice, and in those places in our world that don't have voices yet.
No, that's a beautiful way of putting it. Thank you so much for joining us today, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Okay. Thank you, Brenda.
Bon voyage.